You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Thank you all for coming. This is the Cloud Computing and Emerging Business Models in the Mobile Space panel. My name is Tim Lorden. You may have seen me in the last session. I am the Executive Director of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. And today, you know, we started off with framing what is the mobile net. We had some introductory comments. We tried not to take too much thunder or topical interest away from this particular panel. I thought we did a good job. A lot of people teased up some of the issues for this panel. And what we'll do, what I'll do is I'll introduce our three esteemed panelists. As I mentioned at the beginning of the conference, we lost Anish Chopra today. Not in a gruesome way. He just couldn't arrive and speak. Anish Chopra, who spoke at the State of Net conference and keynoted, was nominated as the federal government's new chief technology officer. We're really happy for him, but we're really furious that he's not able to come and speak until his confirmation hearing before the Senate. So he sends his regrets, but I think we have plenty of things to talk about without Anish. We'll first start off with Paul Bloom, who has a brief presentation, then go to Sasha Sagan, and then go to Roger Entner. Paul Bloom is the CTO for telecom research at IBM, and interestingly enough, in his bio, he's also known as the father of the Advanced Intelligent Network, AIN. He also, before that, spent years and years and years at AT&T in various iterations and AT&T labs, et cetera. Sasha Sagan works for PC Magazine. He is the co-host of PC Magazine Radio as well. And also, he's lead analyst for mobile devices for PC Magazine, which is formerly known as Ziff Davis. I don't know if the name has changed or not. And then Roger Entner, of course, is with Nelson IAG. He's the senior vice president. He covers wireless, wireline, and cable issues, so he has portfolio pretty well full. All the bios for everybody, including Roger's, can be found on the netcaucus.org website in the agenda section. And we also link to Roger's blog from your bio. So feel free to check out the blog. So if I could just ask Paul to start off with a brief presentation, we'll go with opening remarks to Sasha and then with Roger, and then we'll open up for questions. And we have coffee after this. So.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Every year, IBM Research does something called a Global Technology Outlook. We look at technology trends and try to understand the implications on our customers as well as on IBM. 2 years ago, we looked at the mobile web. And one of the things that became very clear is that there's some very interesting things that are happening in devices. And there's also some very interesting things happening in the network. And this was before iPhone got announced and before LTE got announced, which is the new broadband 4G technology. And it became very clear to us that this is going to have a very significant change. So one of the things that you might ask is, why is IBM interested in this? Now, we're not in the device business, we're not in the network business, but we are in the solution business. And if you take a look at what some of the mobile technology, the 4G technology that will start allowing 30, 40, 50, 100 megabits to come down to an end user, or the smartphone technology that you've seen the first generation with iPhone and Android, and you're going to see multiple generations and improvements on those devices, will have a very profound implication on business processes. Virtually every single business process of every enterprise will change because of this technology. So we think that we'll see new businesses emerge from the deployment of 4G technology and the advanced handset technology. We're changing the user experience, taking the desktop experience and moving it to the mobile web, move to the handset, to me is really not the right way to look at this new technology. There will be a new dynamic of how people will use their cell phone to provide mobile computing, very different than someone sitting at their desktop. And we need to understand what that really means. We're also looking at this technology from an emerging country perspective. So we're making a very significant investment to understand how will this 4D technology, how will the mobile technology change different cultures around the world. And we do believe that these changes will have implications here in the United States. We're also spending a lot of time looking at cloud computing and truly to understand how do we start pulling together cloud computing technology together with mobile technology. How do we take advantage of the fact that we're able to virtualize our hardware, having much lower cost of network infrastructure, having the ability to rapidly scale our infrastructure to meet the various demands that will be created by the new applications that will be coming off of new mobile applications? How do we enable innovation? What type of openness is really necessary from a cloud perspective to enable, which we believe will be the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of developers of new applications? So it's not just going to be the AT&Ts or the IBMs or the Apples creating the applications. We need a level of openness that will allow applications to be developed simultaneously on multiple platforms, both from a desktop perspective as well as from a mobile perspective. So we see the integration of mobile technology and cloud technology really enabling the introduction of many new services and many new ways of doing business. To understand what we think the business model will be, you need to understand what the ecosystem is, both from the beginning of the end user all the way back to the provider of content. And in between, the device manufacturers, the network manufacturers, the applications developers, the platforms, the types of services and applications that will be offered through the new paradigm of a mobile web and mobile web infrastructure. But it doesn't come down to the technology. It's not the 4G access technology. It's not the new handsets and the new capabilities provided to them. It's the new applications. We're going to see changes in the way healthcare is being offered, and we're starting to see that today. We're going to see the way education is going to be changing. We've been doing some trials in China right now where we're going to the western provinces of China that have very little interconnection, and we're changing the way education is being offered in China because of the technology that we're talking about here. We're going to see different ways of retail services being offered because there's a lot more information that will be now available because of the technology that will be in the handset, technology that will be in the cloud, and the information, because this is about data. This is about mining the data, mining the information that's available, and using it to the benefit of all the end users and all the citizens. So virtually every single industry is going to be changed because of this type of technology. And we're spending a lot of effort trying to understand how do we enable those changes, how do we accelerate those changes, because we think that this will be not only increasing productivity and innovation, but it will be creating new industries and new jobs around the world. And this is kind of a core of what we kind of envision as a smarter planet. Communication is key. Having intelligent communication, interconnected communication, instrumented communication will really change the way people live and provide and use this new information to create new opportunities across the world. Thank you.
Okay, well, Paul gave you the long-term view there. I think I'm going to focus on a shorter-term view and say that 2010 is going to be a big inflection point for cloud computing in mobile, whatever cloud computing means. The great thing about cloud computing is that you can define cloud computing as almost anything you want, provided it's happening on the internet. So for the purposes of this argument, let's say that cloud computing is any application where the processing and data storage is not happening on your local device. So for instance, Facebook is cloud computing. YouTube is cloud computing because you are basically using your device as a window to something else that's out there. I hate the whole term cloud computing anyway, because what it's really is client-server computing, but that's a different story. Okay, so 2010 is going to be a big inflection point for this on mobile. Why? Because in 2010, we're going to start seeing the first mobile devices that truly incorporate a full set of web standards. A lot of people have been talking maybe for the past 10 years about how Web application providers need to develop exclusively for mobile and do special versions for mobile and use these special mobile standards, and you know what? The web application providers don't do it. You basically need mobile devices to start adapting themselves to the web standards. Well, we're going to start seeing that next year with Adobe Flash appearing on many devices, with Palm's Web OS appearing with its excellent support for web standards, with a lot more interesting things coming in the world of Java and JavaScript on mobile. So you're going to see next year a lot of devices getting into people's hands that are able to access a full range of desktop class cloud applications. Okay, but there's a problem. And the problem is that cloud computing basically assumes unlimited cheap bandwidth. Because on the desktop, up until now, we've basically had unlimited cheap bandwidth. And that means cloud computing is far more dependent on carrier policies and carrier capacity than locally resident applications or stuff you're doing on your device. This is interesting because the policies and practices involving bandwidth and bandwidth capping restrictions, et cetera, are far different in wireless than they are on the desktop, in wireline, and in the usual places where people are used to having cloud applications. For instance, I don't know if you know this, but every single one of the four major providers expressly prohibits you from using their internet as a primary home connection. Okay, if you want to follow their terms of service, every one of the four providers says you can't have us as your only connection. What's the implication of that for cloud computing on mobile and for the expansion of cloud computing on mobile? Carriers have some real serious issues when it comes to capacity. If you look at the iPhone, which is maybe the first true cloud computing mobile device in terms of really, really supporting web standards in an easy-to-use way, well, every time enough iPhone users get together in one place, it breaks AT&T. Okay, you saw this at the South by Southwest conference this year. They basically brought down all of AT&T's network in Austin through a demand for cloud computing. Okay, how are the carriers going to respond to this, and what policy framework do you need to create to encourage both innovation and not completely destroying our wireless infrastructure? Is there going to be innovation in terms of compression? Is there going to be innovation in terms of new cloud applications that use data more efficiently or use less data? And I know Roger is going to say something about Twitter, so I'm not going to steal his thunder, but only tease his thunder. Are we going to go back to the kind of focus we had in the late 1990s with systems like BlackBerry or Palm's PQA system, which say, okay, no, we can't handle the desktop internet here. We are going to have to find a solely mobile solution. These are all questions that are really going to become hot next year as the cloud bursts, all these windows open up, and the networks say, oh my goodness, what is happening to us? So then the question is, where do we go from here? And I think Roger has some ideas on that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. Well, one of the things that comes with the internet, or better, you know, you asked beforehand, you know, will we have one web, or is it a mobile web, or what is it? One of the significant trends that we're seeing is we're going at least on a backbone size to an all IP backbone. And in the end, all that will happen is the way we access that information. Is it a mobile device? Is it your computer? Is it a television set? It doesn't matter. It's all IP. But what's very interesting with mobile and where it gets very interesting with business models is there's a premium that comes for mobility. Twitter is an excellent example. Nobody pays for the constant update stream that you get on your laptop. On your mobile device, you better get an unlimited text messaging plan, or you have you know, a huge phone bill at the end of the month. So what that brings you, and people will pay for access to information on the go, where they will not pay for, you know, when they're sitting down wherever they are. And companies that are actually not monetizing that, their mobile application, I found what the Wall Street Journal did extremely interesting, where they are charging for the website, and they're the only ones that successfully have pulled that off. But they're not charging for the iPhone application. I think that's a huge missed opportunity for them, and a complete break of their consistency. Where people always also will pay for is location-based services. And what we will see is that there will be no separate category called location-based services, but it integrates really into every single application there is. And you have to be careful what you transmit, as we saw earlier, but it allows us, you know, to check what we're doing, where we do it. You know, no longer, you know, you step out of a plane and it tells you the weather wherever you came from. You know, that's not very useful. But here, location-based services can update it. When we look at, you know, many people talk about checking the prices and what is the lowest price that for a certain, you know, everything from a computer to tomatoes. And you can check it then on your mobile device. What a lot of people haven't really thought through is the implications that that has. Because the more information that is available, the lower the profit margin there is. Because when you suddenly have perfect knowledge of, oh, if I go 2 miles down the road, I can have this versus, you know, it might be 12 pack of Coke, you know. It can be as trivial as that, where you can really look through that. People will probably pay for it that you can put your grocery bill on your mobile device, and then it will tell you, if you go to this store versus that store, your bill will be this week $5 lower. And the implication that that has, and people will pay money for that. So there's a huge opportunity to put the information from the internet together with mobility rather than some stationary device, because we all know we're pretty much, when do you need the information? Right now on the go, rather than, you know, with a lot of foreplanning at home. But one of the things that Sasha very talked about is, you know, the difference between wired and wireline, and what that does with what kind of services you can offer. And to give you a background or an idea of what we talk about in terms of bandwidth, it's the average BlackBerry. Everybody here has probably a BlackBerry. Average BlackBerry, what do you think? How many megabytes a month does a BlackBerry use? Anybody? 2 megabytes. Okay. A carrier makes an arm and a leg on your $40 BlackBerry subscription. If we put that same thing on a Windows mobile device, same usage pattern, 40 megabytes. The average laptop, wireless laptop, where you have a 5 gigabyte cap on, about 150 to 200 megabytes usage. Average iPhone, 400 megabytes of use. Huge. And it really, the carriers are not putting these caps on out of willy-nilly reasons that we just don't like this. If we look at streaming video, the other thing that they prohibit is streaming video. Why is that? Well, because that streaming video user is one continuous channel taken up. And on average, you know, on 3G technology, you have 5 channels. So 5 people watching, say, the Wizards or whoever the Wizards play against, say, in the playoffs, if they get there, You know, five people can take down downtown Washington for data usage. If we go that now to 4G generation, we brought that up to about 25 to 30 people that can still kill that out of, what, 10,000, 20,000 people that are there. So the bandwidth that is available on a wireless environment is still very fragile. And, you know, while it seems to be ubiquitous and everywhere and plentiful, it actually is not and will for the foreseeable future not stay there, despite the industry investing $20 billion plus a year. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we got a lot to work with. So I have a bunch of questions. I hope you have a bunch of questions. If I could just ask maybe Paul to clarify one thing that both Sasha and Roger said. I think at one point we said we're moving to an all IP network. And, you know, different, I guess you're talking about fourth generation. Paul, could you explain kind of what that means with regard to different standards up until now, at least here in the U.S.?
Yeah, the two major 4G technology is WiMAX and LTE. Right now, Sprint is trialing WiMAX technology in various places, and the expectation is that now you'll be able to get 10, 15, 20 megabits down bandwidth. Now, obviously, this is initial deployment. When we talk about LTE, which probably won't be coming out until the end of 2010, 2011, they're talking about 40, 50 megabits. If you're already a 3G carrier, you're more likely to evolve to an LTE type of technology. If you're a CDMA like Sprint is, they're setting up a separate company called Zone that they're going to try to push the WiMAX standard. So right now those are competing standards, but the objective is really to increase the bandwidth to decrease the cost of coverage. So the expectation is, as we move into 2011, 2012, you're going to see the type of bandwidth becomes available really to really expand very significantly. And that's where I think we'll start seeing a whole new set of services that will be starting utilizing that type of bandwidth. So today, if you use 3G technology and you try to get download stuff off your BlackBerry, you typically wait for a while. And the user interface is not as appealing as we're going to see in future generations of user interfaces.
Thank you. I'm open to questions at any time, so feel free to raise your hand and take the center mic. But one thing that was interesting when we talked about this particular panel was at one point there were like three or four mobile operating OSs, operating systems. Since last year, there's been an introduction of about two more. Correct me if I'm wrong. So unlike kind of the mobile, unlike the kind of desktop space, where you have just a few operating systems, right now really only three, one major one, and one's gaining steam, and one's Linux, I guess, is still hanging in there. But here you have a proliferation of operating systems. How is this all going to? You talk about everything coming together and being consistent and developing for one platform. We have different devices. We have different CDMA, GSM, LTE, WiMAX. How is this all going to wash out? And how we all is it going to be everything going to be in the cloud as Sasha's predicting in 2010, where the web standards are going to have to be more consistent, or is it just going to be fragmentation going forward?
Well, we have a lot more than three. We have hundreds of operating systems, because every one of your phone that can run an application has an operating system.
So for example,
I talked with anybody know like the game MotoGP? It's a pretty simple motorcycle game. You know, they have more than 6,000 different versions of that game.
Yeah, Roger's talking about feature phones, by the way.
Yeah, feature phones. But we're talking about mobile phones.
Yeah, right.
Not just because the vast majority of Americans have feature phones. And even though, and still today, what do we have? About between 25 and 30% of new phones that are being sold are smartphones. So still the vast majority of what's being sold are feature phones. So we're going to stick with that for most Americans, we're going to stick for that But anyway.
Yeah, I think there's going to be considerable fragmentation well into the future. There are definitely, I mean, this drives developers nuts because, as Roger said, when he says there's 6,000 versions of a motorcycle game, what he means is they're all written in Java, but every single phone has a different Java interpreter, and so you need to write 6,000 versions of the same Java code. There are some moves to smooth that out some and to reduce the fragmentation some. And you see some moves by the carriers to start requiring certain Java standards in their Java phones. You see some moves by carriers, developers, enterprises to move some stuff onto the web as phones become more web compatible. But as we have these two trends pulling in opposite directions, more fragmentation of operating systems at the same time as you're consolidating Java a bit and you're consolidating to web standards a bit, it's still going to be a mess for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic. You know, I take a look at what Apple is doing and Google's doing with Android, where WebKit is kind of a core infrastructure of their platforms. And I think as those type of phones get deployed into the marketplace, and developers start creating applications based on the WebKit standards, and yes, there will be proprietary extensions, that you start seeing a consolidation around a set of web-based type of applications.
Well, and then we go back to the carrier question, because yes, I think absolutely a lot of developers want to standardize and consolidate around web-based applications, especially with this new generation of handsets. But for their applications to run reliably, the networks have to be solid enough and have enough capacity.
So that begs the question, will there have to be some at least management of applications at some point? Whether I think right now the iPhone store is managed by Apple, and they make a lot of decisions. I don't know
but
how they do
also
that.
Work together
with AT&T.
Yeah.
Will we see more of that? Is that possible in kind of more of open source operating systems? Or is that possible? Is that something we're going to see more of or less of?
Well, it's carriers have been experimenting with ideas about restricting certain classes of applications to supposedly, they say it's to protect their networks. Some people argue it's to protect certain business models, but that's debatable. For instance, for about 24 hours, AT&T put out something in their terms of service forbidding you from using anything that redirects television signals. In other words, they were trying to prevent people from using streaming video over their network. They retracted that quickly after about 400 blogs all cried foul. But there's definitely a thought in the carrier world of how can we control or how can we shape the kinds of applications that are going to be used on this network. It's not the free and open internet.
And you're saying, are you saying it shouldn't be?
I'm not saying it shouldn't be. I'm saying that's not how it appears to be right now.
Yeah, and because the physical reality and the economic reality of the mobile web are different than that of the wired world, and the carriers have been very careful around not singling out any specific application so that they don't run headlong into the net neutrality trap. While able to, you know, protect their business model. And because what you don't want is somebody to get a $20 or $30 data plan and then run Skype over it and use it, you know, and basically play rate arbitrage, and which is perfectly human, but the business model is not set up that way because then, you know, one subsidizes the other. So it's very interesting. But the moment, you know, you basically come, you know, in the not too distant future, it can be very conceivable that a carrier will say, okay, you get 1, 5, 10 gigabytes of data, and how you use that is up to you. You can use my carrier-branded voice service, you can use Skype, you can use Jar Jar, whatever. We just subtracted from however many mega gigabytes you buy.
I think the world of control, which has been for the past 100 years in the telecommunications environment, is going to have to change because of the web. And I think we're starting to see kind of over-the-top providers like Google and others who are going to change that business model. And I believe they're going to force the telecom communication providers to change their business model in order to allow this more open environment.
And but in an unlimited resource world, I would completely agree with you. You know, I remember the first days of cable modem, where the cable companies were not able to properly predict how much traffic there was, and you know, in the afternoon it was blazing fast, and you know, 5 o'clock, you know, my dial-up was faster, and in the mobile internet world, the whole communications network will go down,
yeah.
And do we want to have no rules at the with the almost certainty that we will have inferior, you know, the complaints that people have about wireless service today will pale in comparison of what they will do in an environment
now,
when you have no.
We're being so gloomy that I just want to say that a resource-constrained environment does not mean no innovation. It just means innovation starts turning to how to maximize the use of resources. For instance, low-bandwidth applications or bandwidth-optimizing applications begin to become hot. Things like, I'll say Twitter so somebody can check their bingo card, but also if you look at some of the mobile browsers out there, such as Opera Mini and Bolt, these are web browsers that are specifically compressing data on a server side to pump less data through the carrier networks. So there's potentials for a lot of innovation and a lot of new business models there. It's just not necessarily the same business model as you'd have in a world of unlimited bandwidth.
So we've kind of established thus far that there's a lot of complexity, a lot of different fragmentation in the entire ecosystem of the mobile net, whether it's standards from GSM to WiMAX to CDMA, then to different operating systems, different APIs, different handsets. And you're predicting, at one point you were predicting that once a lot of applications get opened up, you could have a crash. So we're not being too gloomy, but there's hope on that front. So let me just move on to one thing, another thing. Stephen Miller from the State Department, you had a question?
Well, if you want to move to another direction, that's okay.
Yeah, I was tying that loop up. So you can start. If you could just use a microphone, that'd be great.
I'll do the Fred Astaire thing here.
Also, the difference in the ownership of two networks, because Sprint and Clearwire now has Google, Comcast, Intel, others in their ownership structures, may lead to different policies. So could you comment on that, please?
Well, I think if you look at from a technology perspective, I expect that the capabilities of each of the technologies eventually will be very similar. Now, the standards may be different, and the interfaces will be different. In fact, there was an effort very recently to try to merge both WiMAX and LTE together. That did not succeed. My guess is that there will be continued efforts to merge these technologies. So from the perspective of the technology perspective, as a user, eventually I'm not going to see a lot of difference between the two, is my expectation.
And LTE networks ride on all IP backbones as well. And the carriers are moving their, basically fragmented core right now that is an IP core and a circuit switched voice core together as well. And in terms of timing, Clearwire has two markets up right now. There are two more launching. They think they will have 50 to 70 markets up this year. Verizon will launch their LTE by the end of the year and be really heavily deployed in 2010. AT&T is putting through its 7.2 megabit HSPA network right now, which is a software upgrade. So I would expect them to be done with that by summer when the next generation iPhone comes out. So they will most likely take advantage of that. So we're really going very rapidly down that road.
And now WiMAX is being built out before LTE, but you also have to remember WiMAX seems to be being built by the Keystone Cops. The Clearwire, first Sprint, then Sprint and their friends, then Sprint sold it to Clearwire and got rid of the Zome name, and then Clearwire changed its name, and these guys have missed so many deadlines and been so embarrassingly bad at meeting their build-out specs that I feel that they are squandering their lead, and especially compared to the network build-out juggernaut that is Verizon, who always meet every build-out deadline, you're going to see those build-outs proceeding at similar paces.
And I think that's an important question just because we're talking about applications and how much bandwidth they use, and that's why we went down this path. The fellow from Clearwire is next door at the infrastructure panel, and you'll be able to – I hope you can't answer the wall.
What about the ownership question? Like this consortium – never mind the confidence, the consortium of Sprint with, and the other companies that want to have a different kind of a fight versus the traditional carrier ownership. Is that going to make a difference in how they're considered policy?
Not really. Well, it's 50% owned by by Sprint, and then all a lot of the cable guys and the little, Google has what, like 10%. The way they are structuring it is as a cable displacement plan, and what I would look very careful at is Portland, where they compete headlong against Comcast, who is their part owner, and so Comcast will sell Clearwire too. So it will be very interesting how that plays out, if they will fight with kid gloves or, go their bare knuckles. And what will be very interesting is the next launch that's coming up is Atlanta, and how the AT&T mobility leadership will react to, the local advertising from Clearwire and driving by the billboard signs with Clearwire telling all their wonderful goods.
Okay, well, let me just if I may, Stephen, move on. One thing that Roger raised on the panel, which was really fascinating because I had heard it the exact inverse. So we talk about mobile business models. You had mentioned that the Wall Street Journal is true. It's the only one, only newspaper I know that people actually charge to read online. They give it away for free on the iPhone. I was not aware of that. But I had read an article just recently where they were talking about how wonderful it is that people will actually pay for iPhone apps and services that they wouldn't have paid for on their desktop computer. So in what is going on with people paying for stuff that they could get for free on the web, on their desktop, on their iPhone, or the inverse? Are people going to start paying more in different contexts? Does micropayments have a lot to do with that? Or is it going to...
I think... With Wall Street Journal, I think it's the typical left-hand, right-hand syndrome of, one company not knowing what the other part of the company is doing. I think that's probably what happened there. But there is clear value in mobility, and people are willing to satisfy their need to have something right now. I don't want to wait to read this thing until I'm at home or at my desk or wherever. I want to have access now. And so that's what people are paying for. And if you're not monetizing that, nobody can help you.
But it's not just a value in mobility. It's a value, it's a larger value in ease and convenience. If you look at the success of the iTunes Music Store, for instance, once again, the iTunes Music Store sells for money something that most people could get pirated for free and that most people know how to get pirated for free. Okay, how have they been so successful at selling it? Well, it isn't because people are altruistic and want to support the record industry. No, it's because it is very easy to find things on iTunes. things. It's easy to buy them. You know you're getting something of an assured quality. It's easy to play it back. It's very convenient. And you see the same thing with these iPhone apps, even versus web applications. It is so much easier and more convenient to read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal through an iPhone app than through a somewhat poorly formatted free web page that people are willing to pay for the convenience.
I see rapt attention, and I know there's questions lurking out there. So feel free. You can.
Paul, you mentioned, and I think this was your second slide, something about retail applications. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more and what the implications for consumers are?
Sure. We're actually doing an experiment now here in the U.S. where we're trying to change the retail experience by using location-based information from a carrier, integrating it with retail information and the databases, as well as some of the call detail records that you have in a carrier's environment. So you can start understanding the whole context of the user. And so maybe you'd be assuming that the user will opt in, send those person's ads when you know he's going from his office to home because he's now passing a particular retail store. Once he comes into the retail store, you will now know what that person wants. You'll know his previous experiences in that store, and you'll be able to target sales for that particular person in that particular context at that particular time.
So at the wrap-up to the last framing session, I think I made I referenced Susan Crawford's comments about location being one of the troika of services that the administration was interested in looking at. Did I overplay the significance of location information, or is location with regard to new business models going to be a big deal, or is it not going to be a big deal?
I think it's going to be very big, but I think location is a small piece of it. And I think context is probably more important. Context of who this person is with, what they're doing, what they have done, where they're going, are they driving, are they on the golf course? All that will change how you present data and information to the end user. So I think context will be very important. You're going to start running into issues around privacy and security, which is another issue that I think we need to kind of grapple with and make sure that the issues around privacy and security don't become a implied barrier to some of these new opportunities.
It'd be great if you could use the, I know it's a kind of a pain to get up there, just because we were recording the audio, and I'd like to get the question.
Well, since this is about cloud computing, and one of the questions I have is, actually it's a two-part question. One is, what do you guys think of Oracle's acquisition of Sun in that context? Sorry. And two, the netbook question that was actually asked in the earlier session, the keynote session, you know, how do you respond to that? Because, you know, it seems like in Europe at least, you know, netbooks are a big thing, especially with carriers. And if you look at the actual cloud activity, Microsoft or, you know, Google, you know, applications in the cloud, you know, how will the adoption or the introduction of netbooks in the U.S. landscape, you know, change cloud computing?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, around netbooks, the netbooks are really moving into the wireless carrier model of handset subsidy. The netbook of today, you know, ASP-wise is in the range of a high-end phone. So it now makes sense to bundle that with a wireless data subscription. And, you know, I foresee that, you know, especially going back to school season this year, would be extremely hot for netbooks because it allows parents in an economically very challenged environment to provide a computer, you know, however limited or powerful it is, to their offspring and pay it partially over time too. You know, and give them ubiquitous connectivity. So it's really a product that comes for the U.S. to maturity at exactly the right time, where everything comes together. You know, the capability of the device, connectivity that hopefully is backed up, because 5 gigabytes for somebody who uses things that they might not should use, like BitTorrent excessively, you know, is used up very quickly and with the right price points. When you look at Sun's acquisition of, or at Oracle's acquisition of Sun, partially it's vertical integration, and you know, it's Larry Ellison having another iconic name as part of his kill list.
I think the issue with netbooks is interesting because I do think, I think as Roger was alluding to, it's going to create a severe strain on the carrier model. Because netbooks are being sold almost as if they're subsidized handsets, but you know what? People use them as if they are just little laptops, and they are just little laptops running laptop operating systems and laptop applications that are not optimized for mobile networks. The software and the usage model on a netbook assumes the sort of high-speed, unlimited bandwidth that we usually have at home or through Wi-Fi. And so as these kids going back to school all pick up their netbooks with their 3G subscriptions on them and start using the 3G-like DSL, that's going to create some interesting strains in the marketplace.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Drew Bennett from Department of Commerce. So everything I'm hearing from here then in terms of limited bandwidth on the mobile networks, moving to the netbook model, AT&T iPhone partnership with applications is so great. Does this mean folks are going to start having to rethink how they feel about network management and net neutrality policies, both on the policy side and the advocacy side? Just talk about that for a minute. Thanks.
And we do have a closing panel on policy framework, so let's not steal too much thunder.
Well, we basically have net neutrality right now only applies to wireline. You know, there's some moves to expand it to wireless, but you know, it's be careful what you wish for, you might get it. And if you have a relatively unlimited bad pipe, then it makes a lot more sense than when you don't. I remember one of the at home, which was one of the very early cable modem providers. Shortly before they went belly up or were bought, they brought out their usage statistics, and the top 5% of users used up 70% of the bandwidth. And the same thing is basically you can replicate on any network. So it's very careful with neutrality, because it usually favors the ones who use the bandwidth heaviest applications.
And I think from a manager perspective, all the management we do today on desktops will have to be done on the smartphones. So the whole area around device management is going to be extremely important in order for the successful deployment of these applications across a wide range of smartphones.
The needle that you have to thread with policy, and I don't know how to thread that needle, but it's there, is how to let the carriers manage their networks so that everyone can successfully access them without the carriers managing their networks to promote specific business models. And the question is how to prefer lower data usage applications as opposed to preferring specific applications that the carriers may or may not want to charge money for or have a deal with or et cetera, et cetera.
One way to do that is with LTE and WiMAX is you have quality of service in it. And you can then say, okay, we are prioritizing this type of application over that. And how do we defend it that nobody will feel discriminated against their favorite one? And then people are buying, or can we actually explain people what they're buying? That they buy a certain amount of bandwidth with a certain amount of priority? And how can we most easily educate customers Because for whatever reason, customers like to buy unlimited whatever plans at the highest possible speed, or they expect the highest possible speed. So to educate consumers that they actually understand what they're buying and what they're getting with this is going to be actually the trickiest part.
It may be instructional to look at Australia, which is, as far as I know, the most severely bandwidth-capped first-world country. And you don't necessarily want to follow in Australia's footsteps, but you might want to look at what's happening in Australia in terms of bandwidth caps, both wireline and wireless, and just take some lessons from that.
Yeah.
Since about 25 to 35% of our registered attendees are from the Federal Trade Commission, I feel like I really want to get into the feasibility from a business model perspective of advertising on mobile devices. We have a panel following this called Privacy on the Go, which will be the privacy aspects of advertising. But the question is, from a business model perspective, leveraging the type of data and advertising and presenting the data, where do you see advertising on mobile devices going, whether it's just displaying smaller banner ads on access web content or displaying ads through the applications like an iPhone app? Again, there's a panel looking at the privacy issues of that, but feasibility, I mean, we're putting actually the horse before the cart. So will it happen, and then should it happen?
Yeah, from a technology perspective, this technology around, like you can do personalized target advertising based on information that is readily available today. One of the issues that we're actually dealing with one of the Asia Pacific companies is around spam, because now customers are saying, well, how do I know this is spam versus a valid advertisement that's really dedicated to me that provides some value? So we're kind of working through those issues. So from a technology perspective, it's very viable. From a business model perspective, now if I can provide targeted advertising, I'm not providing more value to the advertiser because there's a higher probability that person will buy something from me. And the question would be, can I go back through that ecosystem and really identify who are the players who are enabling that targeted advertising? So what is really the right business model? So if I'm AT&T, and if I'm sending a particular ad to Sasha, and Sasha buys something because AT&T sent me a coupon, should AT&T get a part of that transaction? A little different business model.
Well, at Nielsen, we work a lot around advertising and around measuring advertising and such. And when we look at, first of all, we've done tests around it, and we found that mobile advertising has recall rates. People remember a day later advertising on their mobile devices roughly in line with television, which is, you know, the gold standard. Because if you look at this, and that's about, you know, in the 30% range. You know, I think everybody of you has been on the internet today or yesterday. Anybody remember that? Thank you. So that shows you how effective internet advertising is. But when we come to targeting, we have currently such little reach on mobile advertising despite all the hype out there. You can't target effectively because you go down to such a microscopic thing. One example. One of the very large wireless carriers had a contract with a female hygiene product manufacturer to advertise that. And in order, and you would think, you know, about 50% of the population is the target audience. In order to make their reach goal, they had to expand their advertising to the whole user base. They got a lot of calls from men asking, why the heck do I get this advertising, that advertising? But, you know, if we don't have enough reach, then we can fulfill the quotas for half the population. Then you know, you want to target on certain demographic and age and usage specifics. So we're far away. And what actually would be the way smarter way to do this is not targeting, but to use segmentation and use the same approach that they do on television. Because you can look at usage statistics and you can look at, okay, this type of person predominantly watches this kind of things. You know, so if you want to advertise, you know, your proverbial beer and pretzels, well, why don't you go on ESPN's mobile site? You might get them. You know, you don't have to target the 18 to, well, hopefully not 18, but 21 up male to get exactly the same result. And you don't run into all the privacy issues.
Did I hear a...
buying something when at the point of which you're making the decision that I want. And so that would be kind of almost, you know, you're standing right in front of, you know, hey, did you know that like book that you wanted is actually right around the corner? And, you know, that would be kind of an interesting way to measure that whenever that gets there.
I have a question. How does that get presented on you have two, three different devices in front of you. You could get it from.
Pop up and say, hey, by the way, did you think about that? That's pretty creepy.
Does it come in?
Well, it depends.
Presentation's important.
Your father is realizing you're watching Okay magazine. Why don't you step 3 feet to the left?
I work for Homeland Security, so.
Okay.
But I guess what's interesting as a consumer, as a female consumer, I like things that are free. So if somebody gave me, just out of curiosity, if someone gave me my iPhone for free, and they're just like, the only thing we ask of you is that you kind of let us, you know, we're going to be telling you about all these great products as you're walking around the world. And I'll be like, well, that's great. I don't mind that. That means I can talk to my people for free. I can find like the things I want. And if something starts to get creepy, I have some kind of privacy settings. Like nobody else knows where I'm at, but I'm kind of letting them into kind of my world. So they kind of know that, oh, Heather likes like orange gummy bears. So then I know like at 3 o'clock that I'm walking down the street and it pops up. So like, by the way, orange gummy bears are around the corner. It's kind of like taking loot. But applying the retail piece on it.
But to make that worthwhile, you'd be swamped to death with advertising. Because just to give you price point ideas of where mobile advertising is these days, so they're priced in per thousands, CPM. And the price ranges from a few cents per thousand to, you know, about $20. But that's still, like, that's like 2 cents per use seeing it. To make up your, I don't know, the device costs about $500.
Devices are going to be that much in the future, but that's just an idea from
We've been hearing about geo-targeted coupons at mobile technology trade shows for. At least 5 years. And the problem is, 10 years. Okay, do I hear 10? Do I hear 12? The problem is that typically, and every couple of years, a couple of startups pop up and offer, say, we have the geo-targeted coupon solution, and then they disappear. Because the opt-in trauma and the complication of getting retailers, carriers, device manufacturers, the whole ecosystem together, and then everybody opting in is just a business process that nobody has been able to master yet.
Well, I'm going to forget, but the thing about it is like in Japan, I can use my phone to pay for things.
In Japan, you can use – and I can explain the problem there, okay, because I wrote that column. The problem is in Japan, they have this relatively cozy business society where the carriers kind of get together as a cartel and agree on one standard, and they go to all of the credit card companies who agree as a cartel on one standard with the one standard of the carriers. Here, you can't get Visa and MasterCard to agree on one thing. Okay, you can't get AT&T and Verizon to agree on two things. Exactly. Then the FTC is at them. The downside of a competitive environment is that sometimes you don't end up with standards, and that can, yeah, retard innovation. I mean, that's the whole CDMA GSM drama we've had here for 20 years.
Yeah, I actually have a legitimate question.
I thought that was a question. Can you say?
Sake of recording, on the issue of capacity, I'm very fascinated with getting into the mobile banking. I'm very fascinated with what's going on in emerging countries like Africa and Asia. I think that I work for the Homeland Security, and I'm very fascinated with capacity as far as innovations happening in Africa. I mean Nokia. I mean Jan Chipchase. If you have not seen Jan Chipchase's TED conference speech, literally kind of changed the way I was thinking about a few things. The idea is that, in an emerging country, they're using mobility as a leapfrog technology. So in a place where power is, there's not a lot of power, and there's not a lot of infrastructure. And so my question is how do we learn from that? Here we are, this nation of everything. And how do we learn from that, especially what I'm interested in is when we have a time of crisis. So if there's an area we don't have connectivity, we don't have power, how do we learn from that? And I'm really interested, my second piece of that, I'm interested in mobile banking and identity and how that's being wrapped up into mobile devices.
Let me just say, Paul, I did not pay her to ask that question. That's right in your wheelhouse.
We're doing a lot of work in the emerging countries. It's really trying to understand how this mobile technology will change the culture. So let me give you a couple of examples of things that we're doing. We're doing some trials in some remote villages in India where giving them a PC is nothing very useful because they can't read or write. So how can we use voice technology? And people have been trying to use voice technology for many, many years and not very successfully. But how to use voice technology to kind of start bridging that gap. So we created a voice web that is both created via voice and also access voice. So we're starting with just stored voice and seeing how people use the capability of a mobile phone to access an announcement, which is very mundane, to get information. Now, these are people who maybe the doctor comes to the village once a month, but they don't know when. They can call in. They can have to find out. If they want to do commerce, they want to find out when is the peddler coming into town, we're now making them much more efficient. Now, from a banking perspective, these are totally unbanked. And when they take out loans, you're talking about usurious rates of 100% a day. So we're now working with a couple of companies on providing micropayments using the cell phone. And it's not talking about a smartphone. We're talking about the $10 Nokia phone that they are marketing in those parts of the world. And it is changing the way they do business. It's changing cultures. Now, you can view that as they're a disabled environment because they don't read, they don't have banking capabilities. Well, those disabilities exist here in the United States as well.
Absolutely.
So there's no reason why we can't take the technology that we're playing around with, and I can't say it's a mature technology at this point in time, but it's a technology, and we're learning quite a lot about how people are using the technology, because that's the key. You got to make the technology useful. It has to be simple. It has to be useful. It has to add value to their lives. And I think we're starting to see how we're doing that in these rural countries, in these rural areas, and we can apply the same things here in different parts of the United States.
Well, one of the problems with mobile banking in this country, especially for small amounts, is the business terms that the credit card processors have with the vendors. And basically, it is 25 cents per transaction plus a percentage. So if you buy chewing gum and you pay it with a credit card, the retailer loses money on you. and that these very small applications and micropayments, any workaround hasn't gotten yet the ubiquity of, you know, of vendors connecting with a processor to make that work.
Is identity and finance coming on our phone in the United States?
Yeah, and you can do identity with like double blind one-time passwords.
Or biometrics. You can start finding biometrics on your phone in the very near future.
Let me.
And your phone will stay $500.
I already can't text message anybody.
Let me just finish up. We're serving coffee after this. I just heard the other panel wrap up, and the guy from Clearwire might be coming over here, so I want to get out of here as soon as possible. let me just ask the panelists for just one last closing comment. First of all, I want to thank you. I felt very interesting. We covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much. If you were to say, as far as business models in the cloud or on applications, what is the harbinger of what application or what business model do you think is a harbinger of things to come as you see it? That's existing today that you can point to as a case study.
Can we start at that end?
Yeah. I just want to say the same thing. Well, if I would know, I wouldn't say and would start my own company.
Good answer.
I think the amount of data that's going to become available through sensors. Through technology that is able to mine information out of existing databases will change how services be offered to virtually everyone. And I think that's the changes we're going to see in the next few years. I'm very optimistic, and I happen to agree with you, that as a new generation comes into the marketplace and brings their norms on security and privacy and how they use things like a mobile phone, a lot of the things that old guys like me have not been very used to will become standard ways of doing business.
I don't think you can go wrong thinking about messaging and communication. And if you look at the history of the mobile device, you keep seeing people's minds being grabbed by what are essentially new forms of messaging and communication as opposed to, say, banking, whether it be voice calls, becoming SMS, becoming Facebook, becoming Twitter, becoming live video streaming like Quick. People really do want to connect to other people. It's a basic human need, and it's one that they seem to want to use their mobile devices to do.
Well, thank you. Following the session in here, we have Privacy on the Go, which we'll talk about advertising and privacy. Next door, we'll have Spectrum. Let's thank the panelists for a great session.